This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The treacherous waters along the coast of North Carolina are known around the world as the graveyard of the Atlantic. Thousands of ships have run aground on the shifting shoals, from 16th century exploration vessels to German U-boats that sank during World War II. One of the most famous wrecks is that of the infamous pirate Blackbeard. His flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, sank in 1718 near Beaufort Inlet. Since its discovery in 1996, artifacts from the site have been recovered and preserved. Last Thursday, divers with the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources Underwater Archaeology Division brought up a pair of 300-year-old cannons from the site about a mile off Fort Macon. It's a clear, sunny day by the docks at the boathouse at Front Street Village in Beaufort as the crew of the Crystal Coast Lady prepare for our trip to the wreck site. We won't actually be involved in the recovery, but we'd be watching from a safe distance. An attempt to raise the cannons was made June 12th, but was called off due to low water visibility and unfavorable weather conditions. But today's forecast looks promising. After a briefing on the history of Blackbeard, approximately 80 people, including Department of Cultural Resources staff, Queen Anne's Revenge experts, members of the Friends of Queen Anne's Revenge, and guests, started boarding the waiting vessel.
Good morning, welcome aboard. We ask everyone to please be cautious as you move around the vessel, especially when going through the lower and upper deck.
We made our way down Taylor's Creek along the Beaufort waterfront, past Radio Island, before making a left and heading through Beaufort Inlet. Along the way, retired underwater archaeologist and our guide for today's trip, Mark Wild Ramsing, points out a dredging platform just a couple hundred yards off the port side.
Here they are dredging as hard as they can, continuing to dredge and keep this channel open. So back in the old days, you didn't have any of that marked channel, no buoys, no nothing. We are heading out the inlet. We'll go straight out a ways. Ahead of us is the Dan Moore. You'll sort of see it about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock on the vessel's starboard side here.
The Dan Moore is assisting in the cannon recovery. The 85-foot ocean-going research vessel belongs to Cape Fear Community College. It's almost 50 years old and has made over 400 research trips.
Okay, everybody, we are now getting close to the site. You can see the recovery vessel, the Dan Moore. It's the big trawler. This is its last voyage before it's going to be mothballed, and this will be actually the biggest, most ambitious lift, trying to raise 3 cannons.
Since the site of the Queen Anne's Revenge is only about a mile off the coast, the shoreline can easily be seen. As we move into position parallel to the vessel Dan Moore, the American flag flying above Fort Macon is just barely visible off our bow. Directly above the wreck site, another smaller barge-like vessel named Jones Bay is anchored.
The Jones Bay came out. They got up at 4 in the morning. They came out at the first sign of light and started excavating. The problem with the way the weather's been, every time they get it ready to go, if another good storm from the southwest comes along, it covers up what they've done. So they had to excavate these cannons. They're already strapped up. They'll be strapped up with big canvas straps or ropes, and you'll see that. Jones Bay, this is Crystal Coast Lady, over.
This is Jones Bay, go ahead.
How's it going over there?
They're about to lift the cannon. They're inflating the bag now.
All right.
To bring the cannon to the surface, divers attach a lift bag to the canvas strap secured around the cannon. The water is only about 25 feet deep at the wreck site, so it doesn't take long for the cannon to float to the surface.
Momentarily, you should see a yellow lift bag come up, or these much bigger than the little buoys you see there, come up right behind the vessel, the Jones Bay, the smaller vessel.
About 5 minutes pass, and then the yellow lift bag breaks the surface of the water.
All right, there it is. So we passed the first stage. Now the second is to get the bag and the divers over to the Dan Moore.
Dan, well, go ahead and haul in the cannon. Haul in the lift bag, over. Haul it in.
On the deck of the Dan Moore, a team of students with Cape Fear Community College's Marine Technology Program began tugging at a red rope connected to the cannon and the divers about 150 feet away. Onlookers watched nervously as the divers are tossed around by the wind and waves. Then a troubling message comes over the radio.
Dan Moore, it looks like they're wrapped around that mooring. Over.
I don't know if you heard that, but what's happened now is that the cannon is hooked around one of the mooring lines. So as the Dan Moore tries to pull it, it's not pulling. So now the divers have gone back down to try to release that.
Another tense 5 minutes pass, and finally the red rope is free from the mooring line. The lift bag, cannon, and divers continue to be hauled in until they're floating beside the Dan Moore. This is where the third phase of the lifting process begins. The expert divers with the Department of Cultural Resources Underwater Archaeology Division work quickly to connect the vessel's crane hook to the canvas strap around the cannon. Then the signal is given to lift the cannon from the water.
All right, so now they're hooked to the cannon. The bladder bags have been moved off a little bit, and we should see Blackbeard's big 6-pounder cannon coming up. They weigh about 2,500 pounds, over a ton of metal and some concretion.
We watch and wait several more minutes as the crane reels it in. And for the first time in almost 300 years, the cannon breaks the surface of the water.
There it is.
Oh my God.
I'd love to see it come out of the water, but I don't cheer until it gets down on the deck.
Even though the 3-century-old artifact is covered in concretion, it's very easy to tell that it's a cannon. As it's slowly lifted out of the water, the crew aboard the Dan Moore lean over the side of the boat to stabilize the cannon and keep it from swaying. Other crew members set up a cinder block and 2x4 platform for the cannon to rest on. Then it's gently lowered as onlookers watch intently.
Yeah, big round of applause. Let them know. Let them know. They know they can't hear you. There you go. Let them know.
The Department of Cultural Resources Underwater Archaeology Division had a goal of lifting 3 cannons during last Thursday's offshore excursion. However, they were only able to lift 2. As the divers and underwater archaeology team celebrate their successful lift, Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Lab Director and Chief Conservator Sarah Watkins Kenny's work is just beginning. She says the cannons will be taken to the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab at East Carolina University in Greenville, where they'll remove the concretion and prepare them for exhibition.
These things have been in the ocean for 300 years. We want to do as little as possible to disturb that environment they've been in, because we can, if they dry out before we treat them, then that can get chemical and physical changes that could damage the object. So we want to prevent that happening. So we keep everything wet and then get it into tanks. Then it's safe. And then we can take a deep breath, and then we figure out next what we do next with it, which will be eventually cleaning, eventually getting all the salts out, drying them, surface finishing them, and then finally they'll go to the museum for display.
So far, about 280,000 items, including the ship's bell, straight pins, gold flakes, lead shot, bottles, and guns, have been recovered from the wreck. One of the 3,000-pound anchors, more than 11 feet long and 7 feet across, was brought up in 2011. It's currently soaking in a huge vat at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab, where it will stay for a few more years. The conservation of artifacts from the wreck site has been ongoing for 16 years. In order to keep the program going, Chief Deputy Secretary with the Department of Cultural Resources, Karen Cochran, says they've had to shift funding sources.
Years ago, when this first was discovered, the state was heavily involved in funding. But over time, as you can imagine, the funding to support something of this endeavor is always going to need some private support. And so this is a partnership like we have in a lot of our areas within the Department of Cultural Resources, that we have a partnership with private supporters and public funding to make some things like this happen.
The Friends of the Queen Anne's Revenge is a private, not-for-profit group that supports the work of the state of North Carolina on the recovery of the wreck of Blackbeard's flagship. Richard Lawrence is president of the Friends of Queen Anne's Revenge and the former deputy state underwater archaeologist for the Department of Cultural Resources. He says the site and the artifacts are part of North Carolina history and need to be preserved.
If you were to ask a person to identify or name a pirate, the average person on the street, probably the first one to come to mind would be Blackbeard. And the fact that we have Blackbeard's flagship just a mile off our North Carolina coast it's just an incredible opportunity for us.
If you want to learn more about Blackbeard and his ties to North Carolina, you can view artifacts from the Queen Anne's Revenge at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort. There is also a model of the underwater wreck site and the ship's bell. To see pictures from last week's cannon raising, visit our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. How do you pronounce crayon? When you were a kid, did you chase lightning bugs or fireflies? If you stepped outside and someone said, "The devil's beating his wife," would you know what that meant? WFAE's Mark Rumsey talks with a North Carolina State student researcher whose color-coded dialect maps have become an internet sensation.
Regional pronunciations and colloquialisms intrigue many of us, but for Joshua Katz, illustrating dialect distinctions is quickly becoming a claim to fame. Katz is a PhD student at NC State. His recently released internet maps showing regional speech patterns have gone viral. They're generating international publicity coverage ranging from local TV markets to the Huffington Post. Katz joins me now to talk about all of this. And Mr. Katz, what's going on, do you think? Why have these maps become such a big hit?
You know, I really don't know. I'm going to leave that to other people to speculate on. I mean, for me, it's just been incredible. You know, I've gotten a lot of calls from people just telling me, "Oh, my friends and I stayed up all night just going through your maps," and you're like, "Well, what do you say? I say this, I say that." And people seem to have enjoyed it and had a lot of fun with it, so if I can contribute to that in some small way, I think that's a win.
So there's research out there demonstrating these regional distinctions. Tell me about that and how you have employed that research.
Yeah, that's right. So the survey data, these 120 questions showing these regional dialect differences, all of this originally came from data collected by a linguistics researcher named Bert Vox. And it's all posted on his site, so you'll have these maps just showing each observation as a single color-coded point. What I wanted to do was to take those maps and go from that data to deriving a smoothed estimate so that you can see the distribution of language across the entire country.
Okay, so for example, and I've got one of these maps pulled up on the computer right now, and I'm looking at the map for the word that is spelled C-A-R-A-M-E-L, and I see a lot of red on that map, and I see some blue. So tell me what's going on there.
Sure. So where you see red, that's where people tend to pronounce the word with two syllables, so caramel. Where you see blue, that's where people tend to pronounce the word with three syllables, or caramel. Now, what's important with these maps, none of it is black and white. It's all on a gradient. So the stronger red areas, you see even more people will pronounce it with two syllables. And the really strong blue areas, even more people will pronounce it with three. But in both places, you still get a mix.
And going back for just a second to that colloquialism about the devil beating his wife, it's not a theological statement, right?
So that is one that I was completely surprised by. I assumed that sunshower was a national term. And then through the course of doing this project, not only did I learn that the vast majority of the country doesn't call it a sunshower, but there is that small region of the South where they refer to it as the devil beating his wife. And I didn't even believe that that was true, but a friend of mine assured me that it was absolutely true, that his mother had told them all that. Growing up, he said it was, yep, it's the devil beating his wife, and the raindrops are her tears.
So, sun shower, you use that phrase, basically when it's raining and the sun is shining at the same time.
Exactly.
That's what we're talking about.
Right.
Well, Mr. Katz, thanks for talking with me, and thanks for giving folks something to entertain themselves with.
Oh, thank you.
If you'd like to see the color-coded dialect maps, visit our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. We're at that time of year where it's sunshine all the time. It's getting hot, and soon it's going to be much, much hotter. And you know what one of the best things is you can do to keep cool in the summer? Shade. Shade that comes from trees. Did you know that trees planted in front of south-facing walls can reduce the temperature on those walls by 30 degrees? And although those trees seem tiny when you plant them, time goes fast. I have one crepe myrtle and one river birch in my front yard that were planted, it just wasn't that many years ago. And they're now huge. If you want trees here in eastern North Carolina, choose the correct trees for your location. You want trees adapted to our area. You can find what trees grow well here through Cooperative Extension. As a matter of fact, on my county website, carteret.ces.ncsu.edu, on the lawn and garden page, there's a list of all sorts of highly adapted trees. A couple of things to think about when you choose your trees. Think about how much space you have and what the mature height and width and shape is of each tree that you're considering. I can't tell you how many times people have come in and asked me how they can prune. Oh, it breaks my heart. Gorgeous crepe myrtles, trees that grow the particular variety they have to 40, 50, 60 feet, but they want to fit them into a space that needs a 10-foot tree. Don't do that to your trees. Choose a tree that fits the space that you have. By the way, unless you're pruning out damaged or broken branches, it's really a bad idea. You go in and lop off those branches, and what happens? You get tufts of weak, tiny branches growing out all in a little cluster. The branches are growing at the wrong angle. They will never have the beautiful shape of the mature branches had you left the tree alone. And yes, you may get 8 or 10 additional flower clusters because you have that puff of sick, weak branches, each with its own little flower cluster. And that will last for a few weeks each year. But the tree, well, it's essentially ruined. So pick your tree carefully. Think about your space. Choose the right one. Remember, it's going to give you that shade you need in future Julys and Augusts. And yes, I know, grass isn't going to grow well under the tree. But you know what? Is that really a bad thing? Which would you rather have, a gorgeous spreading tree with deep, cool shade or more hot grass to mow? I hope you decide that a tree or two should be planted in your yard this summer. And yes, it's okay to plant them now. Just make sure you keep them well watered through the heat of summer. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Cover bands have made their money presenting the familiar, no original tunes, no deep cuts from the album, just the hits and nothing but the hits. Lightning Wells could be fairly called a cover artist. There are no original tunes on any of his recorded output or his live performances, but that's where the comparison ends, as the Fountain resident delves into the old-time music such as a historian would, as well as a musician. George Olson has this, which originally aired in February 2012.
Mike, Lightning Wells is old school enough when he takes you through his history as a working musician. He does it not on a tablet computer or any computer for that matter, but in a scrapbook.
It's like my musical scrapbooks. I started playing, when I was a kid. I had a little band when I was like 13. It's before I played the guitar. My first instrument was harmonica that I got in the third grade.
And in a band called The Unknowns.
The Unknowns. We were, too.
But perhaps it's not too surprising Lightning is old school in his keeping of memories because he's old school in his music as well. He doesn't write his own material but mines a deep tradition of old-time music.
I would say I'm pretty much a traditional musician. I'm doing music from white and black cultures, but I've kind of broadened that too. I'm doing some pop music from the 20s. It's all old music. It all fits together somehow. It's American music.
Freight train runs so fast. Freight train runs so fast. Please don't tell what train I'm on so they won't know where I've gone.
Lightnin' didn't start out in the old-time vein. The music of that first band, The Unknowns, was made after the British invasion of the 1960s had hit, and that was about the time the next musical trend started to get popular attention.
It's like I was starting to play guitar, and it was about the tail end of the folk revival in the 60s, when the folk singers were playing in Newport Folk Festival and places like that, probably through like early Dylan. And I was playing some of that stuff, and it's like, who did Dylan listen to? Woody Guthrie. I got into him when I was pretty young. And who did Woody listen to? He hung out with Sonny Terry and Lead Belly. I got into them. It's kind of a moving backwards type thing.
Fix me something, let my coffee get cold. Don't forget to save my sweet jelly roll. Well, you know she ain't crazy about me. She's jiving that way.
A lot of the modern musicians at those 1960s Newport folk festivals used the opportunity to introduce audiences to old-time Delta and Piedmont blues performers like Mississippi John Hurt. Lightnin' got to listening to them and eventually learned his first Piedmont blues song, an old 78 by the Durham blues player Blind Boy Fuller, Looking for My Woman. Some 40-odd years later, Lightnin' now says he has hundreds and hundreds of songs in his head, many of them learned at the hands of the people who sustained traditions like the Piedmont blues, such as Johnston County's Al Jermay Hinton.
Stop by and see her, and I'll play the guitar, she'll sing. But her big showpiece was the Buck Dance, and she'd hit taps on her shoes, and she'd play the guitar and Buck Dance at the same time. And then she'd raise the guitar and play it behind her head while she Buck Danced, and that was always got the crowd going. That was her showstopper. I always called her the Rock and Roll Grandma.
He also had the chance to learn from and perform with a man he calls his blues daddy, the Beaufort blues man Big Boy Henry, who passed away in 2004 at the age of 83. Lightnin' says Big Boy's less-than-structured performance style gave him a lot of confidence, declaring, "I played with Big Boy Henry. I can play with anybody."
We played at Lincoln Center. It wasn't indoors Lincoln Center. It was at the outdoor Lincoln Center, Damrosch Park behind it, which is a highly coveted gig. So we're on stage. I'm with Big Boy. It was always, fly by the seat of your pants playing with him. You didn't know what to do. It's like he would change beats or something, and you just had to watch the old man and change when he changed, which a lot of other people that played with him had a problem with. They wanted to play strict 12 bar, and he'd be getting them messed up. But we're on stage up there, it's like, okay, Big Boy, what do you want to do next? And play a slow one, an E or A, it doesn't matter. So it's just like you start playing, he starts making a blues song out of his head, which always ended up pretty well.
Well, John Henry said to his shaker, "Shaker, why don't you sing? 'Cause I'm throwing 12 pounds from my hips on down. Just listen to that cold steel ring. Listen to that cold steel ring."
Going through Lightnin's scrapbook, you'll see a lot of legendary blues performers, many right here in North Carolina, including Durham's John D. Holman and Tarboro's George Higgs, a Piedmont performer Lightnin' refers to as one of the last of the last. But even with those original practitioners dying off and Lightnin' performing traditional music for multiple decades, he's always been able to find something new to help sustain his interest.
Floyd Council recorded with Blind Boy Fuller in the 30s, and he did 8 songs on his own. That's the latest thing. I discovered him, and I learned 3 Floyd Council songs. I said, okay, this will be easy. You know, he's kind of like a poor man's Blind Boy Fuller. Started getting the songs, like, wait a minute now, he's a little harder than I thought. I had to do some work there. He's a pretty good guitar player.
I want to say something, Mama. I want you to understand. Don't begin my loving to some other man. I'm grieving and I'm worrying. Babe, I'm grieving and I'm worrying. Babe, I'm grieving and I'm worrying. Mama, about the way you do.
You go through Lightnin's discography and you won't find any self-penned tunes, not from a lack of interest in writing, but in a belief there's always something new out there. That belief is backed up by his discoveries of old-time performers like Floyd Council, which enables him to add to those hundreds and hundreds of songs already firmly implanted in his head.
Yeah, I have an English degree, and I like to write, but I just never went down that way of creative writing my own music. yeah, I just feel like there's such a depth of material out there that, you know, somebody needs to do this, and that's what I do.
Big electric fan to keep me cool while I sleep. Little baby girl to play around daddy's feet. I'm a rambling gambler, and I'm drunk every night. I tell you, boys, I'm ragged but right.
Mike Lightnin' Wells resides in Fountain. His most recent recorded work is the Pink and Mr. Floyd collaboration with Tad Walters and Bullfrog Willard McGee, which includes the aforementioned music of Floyd Council. Lightnin' performs Saturday night at 8 o'clock at the Union Alley Coffee House in downtown Washington in a show sponsored by the Beaufort County Traditional Music Association. I'm George Olson.